Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. We have two guests that we're going to be talking with today. The first one is, well, a woman that I think is quite incredible because of her blatant honesty about dealing with the issue of weight, the big W, or maybe it should be the big O. I don't know which way you want to look at it, but whether you are 5 or 10 pounds overweight or whether you're 120 pounds overweight or more, it's always that issue of our own self-image. If you've ever done any kind of dieting program, if you've ever gone through anything, you know the frustrations of having to deal with that on a daily basis. Well, the lady that is with us today, Diane Carbonell, is a woman that has put out a book called 150 Pounds Gone Forever. She lost half of her size, and it is her joy to be able to share with you that you can achieve what she has achieved, and it doesn't have to be absolutely, frustrating. You don't have to beat yourself up all the time. Diane, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Donna.
Diane, you are a woman that is so candid in this book, and I was absolutely amazed to find that you have 7 children, that you maintained weight. Women, after they have babies, it's so easy to pack on those pounds, and by golly, you have been able to keep your weight down. But what really got me was when you said you had been to 8 Weight Watchers 82 times. Diane, I can't even fathom that. 82 times? That's incredible. Okay, we've got to find out about your story. Now, there's a before and after picture in the book, but people can't see that. So tell us your story. And how did you end up gaining so much weight?
That is, such an important question, how I gained it and then how it was to live at that life of a morbidly obese woman and then finally how I lost it. And fortunately, I was an average size when I was growing up, all the way through high school and college. I was just normal. You would look to me and thought normal, healthy, young person. So I was blessed from that point of view. When I got married is when my initial weight gain happened, and it was really because I stopped moving around, so I became very sedentary. Mm-hmm. I went from, my house to my job and back home again and never really walked or made any effort to exercise. And then I also discovered, to my chagrin, that the only thing I knew how to cook after I got married was desserts. I was great at making cakes, but I really had no idea how to plan a meal or make a salad. My mom always did all the cooking, and then I would just play in the kitchen by making desserts. I was great at that. But instead of learning how to cook, my husband and I went out to eat a lot. So I was really packing on the calories, from those restaurant meals and snack mm-hmm. foods that I would purchase instead of, making some healthy meals. So the first 3 years, I gained about 50 pounds.
Oh, my just goodness.
Just by doing those things, not exercising and just eating too much food. And then the third year of our marriage, I got pregnant with my first daughter, and I gained 75 pounds.
Oh, my word. That's a lot of weight to be carrying, extra weight to be carrying during a pregnancy.
It was. And my doctor warned me, mid-pregnancy, I had already gained about 50 pounds, and he sent me to a nutritionist, and she was very nice, but I looked at this slim woman across the desk from me, and I thought, you don't understand, mm-hmm. What I'm going through. And so she told me all the right things to do, and I just ignored her advice and just kept gaining weight. And, of course, now looking back with hindsight, I realize what a mistake that was, because that set me up for another 7 years of obesity. Because when I went in to deliver my first daughter, I weighed 274 pounds.
Oh, my goodness. And how tall were you?
I'm 5'10", So, you know, I am tall, but that's still way too much weight, no matter how tall you are, unless you're a linebacker, you know.
Yeah, and even then, they look too chunky.
They do, you're correct.
Yeah, I've seen some of these guys playing in sports that have, they eat this massive amount of food, and even though they're out playing football, you look at them and you go, you're a potential health risk here. So
yes.
When we're talking about this, we need to be aware. Guys, I know the image is, you know, stuff the face, you can eat anything, and when you're young, you put on this weight, but there are consequences that evolve with the health. And with you, boy, could I relate to this. I remember after I had my daughter, I think I was 30 pounds heavier than what I'd been before, which, you know, to a lot of women, they say, oh, well, that's nothing. Well, I remember hearing all the stories about, gee, it's going to fall off.
Yes, me too. I really thought, it seemed, I don't know how your friends were, but my friends seemed to have babies, and then they would just go back to their size.
Oh,
and I never bothered to ask them, you know, did you have to do anything? And, of course, now looking back, I realized they did. They exercised, and they watched what they ate. Whereas I just thought somehow magically those 75 pounds would come off, but they never did.
Oh, boy, that's the truth. You went so many times. I mean, you knew. You reached a point where you said, I don't want to look like this. You've got beautiful photos of yourself and your family. Your husband didn't put you down, which is amazing, because I know of so many women whose husbands are just atrocious when it comes to this. And the women just feel so badly about themselves. It just seems to compound the problem.
Right. Absolutely it does. And I asked my husband after I lost the weight, I said, you were so gracious to me. He was always one like, let's go shopping and get you some flattering clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what did you think during that time that I was, you know, 300 pounds? And you know what he told me? He said, I really thought you would just lose it eventually. He said, I just never thought it was permanent. So he, I guess because he saw me continually trying to diet, you know, in one fashion or the other. So he was very supportive.
Now, you found that there were a lot of components inside of you that you were dealing with relative to weight. Let's face it, in our society, people that carry around abnormal amounts of weight are looked down on. They really, they are judged. And some of the judgment is not bad because, you have a very serious health problem.
Right.
And if nothing else, I mean, I think of people that have had problems with their bones and their joints. Well, you cannot carry around an extra 50, 100, you know, 150, 200 extra pounds. And with some individuals, it's even more than that.
Yes.
Your body cannot function. Your heart is going to have to work so many times harder to do its job. You've got all of these things that can occur. What was the big aha for you? When I say aha, I know there's not some great angelic choir screaming down, "Ooh, you got it." No, that's not what happened. What happened inside of you? I mean, what was it that made you say, "I'm going to take control"? I mean, Weight Watchers 82 times?
I know.
Jeez.
I think what did it for me, it was two things. I realized it happened when I was on my doctor's scale. And like you said, your mind can just go so quickly. And it was kind of at that moment I realized I had to do something. And for me, it came down to two things. One, like you just said so eloquently, my health. You know, I started to get afraid. I was young enough that I hadn't really begun to experience the health consequences that can come from years of obesity. So from that point of view, I was lucky. So my health was a reason. I was afraid. I had already gained up to 300 pounds, and I had never lost weight successfully, so I thought, could I end up 350 or 400? Like, what was the stopping point for me? And I think that really scared me, because I didn't want to be housebound or be like these people you see on TV that had to be cut out of their homes, you know, or sit in a wheelchair. And my second reason was my children. At that point, I had three small children, ages 7 and under, and I was already not able to keep up with them. You know, I was doing all the right mom things, the cooking and taking them places and stuff, but if they wanted me to go out into the yard to play, I would go out in the yard and sit, and I would watch them play, you know, to keep them safe. But I would never get on a bicycle, you know, and ride bikes with them or kick the soccer ball. And I thought, okay, I can't participate in their activities the way I would like to, and what if my obesity leads to my premature death, and I leave my kids? before it's time because of what I'm putting in my mouth. So those two reasons, my health and my children, that kind of snapped for me. And I was like, I've got to do something today. So that was the beginning.
In your book, and you have some marvelous questions that you have throughout your book to help individuals, male or female, to be able to really look at themselves. And what I think it's so important is that we can all sabotage ourselves. And so many times it's subconscious. And that's something that you make a comment in your book. And in fact, you pose it in the form of a question. Are you standing in your own way? And when you finally were able to answer that question for yourself, and that's what I like about your book, you're not in drama. What you're trying to do is say, look, this is who I was. Food was my recreation, quoting words out of your book. And as you said, you didn't move very much, but you came to that point where you said that I was the one that was standing in my own way.
Right.
That is quite a statement, because all too many people just don't even want to admit that. They want to blame something outside, it's within themselves.
It is within ourselves, and I think that taking that personal responsibility is just such a vital part of, you know, successful long-term weight loss. Because even sometimes I think when we diet using a good program like Weight Watchers or one of those programs, it's easy to just get really focused on like your food choices and not focus enough internally and think, why was I in this place in the very beginning, you know? And it's me. I have to take responsibility. I always tell people, you hold the fork. I held my own fork, you know? Nobody was forcing food, you know, down my throat. It all finally came down to me, you know? And, you know, I think I talk in my book, too, about, like, I could look in the mirror and not really see myself or what I had become.
Yes,
and I think,
another
part of our self-awareness when it comes to this weight is to really be able to take a step back and look at yourself and think, where am I right now? What have I done to put myself in this position? And most importantly, what can I do to move out of this? And
I really like what you've just said. In fact, I have to share with you quickly a story about a woman I know. Her name is Ruth. Ruth is about 5 foot 1.5 inches tall. She weighs about 250 pounds. She has diabetes. She is a woman who is in her early 40s. She has battled with weight for years and years and years, and she came to a point, just like you did, and she said, I am responsible for what I put in my mouth. And she's got a member of family that also has a problem with obesity, and they're going in for stomach stapling. She's very concerned about this for them. She said, this is not, you're not changing what is at the core. And she said, I'm responsible for what I put in my mouth. Now, she's been losing weight gradually. We've been sharing a lot of material, and she's so pleased with that. But she said, I cannot. I just don't even want to consider a surgery because I know how dangerous it is, number one. But she said also, that's not resolving it. I've got to take charge. It's because of what I've done that I've gotten into the situation where I have with foods and this type of thing. And so what you've said really is quite significant. And I think that this is why your book, 150 Pounds Gone Forever, is so very important. You say you choose to look at your life as a whole. Instead of focusing on a scale, you have specific goals for yourself. How do you deal with, gee whiz, I might fail at what I'm doing?
The fear of failure is real when it comes to weight loss. And I think so many of us, and myself included, tried to diet so many times that sometimes you're almost afraid to try again because you're afraid you're going to fail. You're going to fail yourself, you know, fail your family, who, of course, is hoping that you'll get healthier, you know, fail your kids. And I think for me, it became the point of, it's okay to fail, because if I don't at least try, you know, I'm never going to succeed. So I always, you know, encourage people, and what I did myself was just kind of confront that fear. Like, I am afraid to fail, but I'm more afraid of continuing this path of obesity that I'm living right now. So,
let's,
you know, just kind of acknowledge the failure and, you know, the fear, and just keep moving forward.
One of your big issues was portions.
Yes.
And I think everybody can recall a time when they've eaten 2, 3, or 4, or 5, or 25 portions of something that just was so scrumptious.
Yes.
Portions are very important. How were you able to work with the portion situation? Because I think that is a big challenge for a lot of people in restaurants. Good Lord, you will get portions that could feed three people.
Yes, you will. And I didn't want to count calories, so I decided to use portion control as a way to just naturally lower my calorie intake. And at 300 pounds, like you just said, I was eating three, four, five portions of all different kinds of foods at a time. And so that was an adjustment for me. But I just started really simply by just looking at the label on the boxes. Because it's easy, it can be kind of a form of denial. If you don't read the label, then you don't know that, like, five crackers has 80 calories, you know? So I think just starting to educate myself over what a portion really looked like. And we are so we're so desensitized to the portion thing now because of, like, restaurants and the servings that we, you know, see at buffet lines and things, that if we think back to how our grandparents ate, when my grandmother comes to visit, you know, she just wants a little potato and she just wants a little piece of chicken because that's how she grew up. I mean, that was an appropriate serving, and the obesity rates weren't nearly what they are today. So for me, it was like learning, retraining my mind visually that, you know, a little piece of chicken was really all I needed. And I could have as much salad as I wanted, but I couldn't drizzle it with a cup of dressing. You know, I could just have a little bit. So it was just a retraining process. And now when I see those huge portions at restaurants and we go out to eat, I'm just kind of horrified. Like, who? Nobody should eat that much. You know?
You bring out a quote that the Americans spend more than $58 billion. That's a B, folks. $58 billion on weight loss-related products.
Right.
Now, that came through the American Dietetic Association. Your comment about portions, there is no quick fix. I don't care where you go, you're going to see ads, lose 25, 30 pounds in a week if you follow XYZ. Well, I'm sorry. It's just not going to happen that
right.
way. I have a recollection of a woman that I knew whose name was Peggy. Peggy had to weigh about 350 to 400 pounds, had about a 5'3" frame. When I knew this dear lady, she was just miserable. And they put her in a hospital, put her on a water diet. She gained 5 pounds when she was in the hospital. She didn't cheat. Now, that's heartbreaking. When you hear stories, and that's what causes people to get so discouraged. So your story is just absolutely so inspiring because you're so honest. 150 pounds gone forever. Now, I know we're just about out of time, Diane. You have a website called fittothefinish.com. FitToTheFinish.com. Quickly, what will people find on your website?
What they'll find on my website, I have quite a few recipes. I have a blog where I blog three times a week about weight loss, about ways, strategies you can use to lose weight, different things that come up in the media, like the McDonald's latest controversy with their fruit drink for kids that's supposed to be healthy for them. And so I just blog about all kinds of things. I have a large readership, and they have great comments, and you'll find a lot of encouragement there, and I don't sell anything. So don't be afraid to go check it out.
Well, there you have it. If you have had the concern about the Battle of the Bulge, I know very few people who have not had that problem.
Right.
So, and as we get older, many times it's easier to pack it on unless you're physically active. There's no shortcuts, but Diane Carbonell, and her last name is spelled Carbonell, is just really an inspiration. Her book is marvelous. No magic bullets here, just the real story of a real woman with 7 children who said, I'm taking charge of my life. Now, go to her website, fittothefinish.com. fittothefinish.com. Also, she has a blog. You go to fittothefinish.com/blog. Check it out. I really think this is absolutely marvelous. Diane, I wish you the very best in all of your endeavors, and thank you for putting your story out there because I think it's really a good one and an inspiration to those that battle this every day.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
It's been a delight. 150 pounds gone forever. How Diane Carbonell lost half her size, and she wants to help you lose as well. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break, and when we come back, We are going to be talking with Beverly Thompson. The Colonel is a lady. Don't go away.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hello and welcome back. This is Donna Sebo. Today is a day where we are having a holiday, Memorial Day, and we also are giving remembrance to those men and women who have served in the military. This holiday is a very special one, and we have a very special story to share. It's about a woman. Her name is Evangeline Jameson. You won't know her name. I didn't know her name. But because of a woman by the name of Beverly Thompson, we were able to find out about this phenomenal lady. Beverly has put together a magnificent book called The Colonel is a Lady. Beverly, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Donna. It's an honor to speak with you today.
I was so impressed about this woman, and her story is just incredible. I looked at a poster that you have on the back of the book, and it's related to the Vietnam Women's Memorial Project, and it's got a pair of dog tags on a chain, and the statement is, not all women wore love beads in the 60s. That is a very powerful statement, and I have a great deal of respect and appreciation for women like Evangeline, and I feel like so many times their voices are never heard, and I really consider it a privilege to be able to talk about this very, very fine lady. But first, tell me, Beverly, how did you come to know her, and how did you get the opportunity to write the story about her life? This is a woman that just really doesn't care if the world ever knows about what she did.
That's why I wrote the book, because she's so humble. I met her at a flag raising in Danville, California, and after she gave a speech, I said, I want to shake your hand and thank you for all you've done for our country. And she said, are you a vet? I said, no, but I did Red Cross work in Japan. I would go out and talk with the worst wounded that were being flown in from evacuation hospitals like hers in Vietnam. And she said, well, you're a vet, too. I said, well, not really, but she said, come on up to the house, and we'll get some Chinese food, and we'll talk, and about our experiences. And she showed me her photo album from Vietnam, and I said, right there, I said, somebody ought to write a book about you. She said, oh, no, honey, nobody wants to hear what a little old gray-haired lady has to say. But that's what really inspired me, is how humble she was. She didn't really realize all that she had accomplished.
I think that's true. She was just busy about living and doing what she had a passion for. Now, she was an Army nurse. She served in 3 wars on 4 continents. That makes you pretty tough.
Yes.
I don't know how anyone, when you see war, when you are putting together the bodies of those soldiers that have been wounded, civilians, you become tough or you become like sand. You just don't have, you just can't function in life very well.
That's right.
And she was one that moved forward. And she was, oh my goodness, such an independent female.
Yes, she was. And it was her love for her fellow man that was driving her. And when she was in New Guinea, there was a suicide of the head nurse, and here were all these young nurses halfway around the world and in the middle of a war. And it was very frightening to all of them, but not to Jamie. And she made a resolve right then and there that she, as a senior nurse, would be there for the younger nurses and wouldn't let them down. She'd be strong for them. And she turned down the love of her life who wanted to marry her. She met him in New Guinea. And that would be difficult for women to do. A lot of the nurses married and went home, but no, Jamie stayed on. She soldiered on for three more wars. And she was also the driving force behind and the creation behind the Vietnam Women's Memorial in Washington.
Yes, that's true. But let's back up a little bit, because this woman has a story that has so many levels to it.
Mm-hmm.
Her proper name is Evangeline, but she was given the name Jamie because they just said, wait a minute, Evangeline's too hard to say. We've got to make it short, sweet, simple.
Yes.
So she ended up with the name Jamie. Now, at the time when she graduated, which was in 1942,
yes,
she was a nurse, and she decided on the Army. Why did she decide on the Army rather than another branch of service? Now, I know women in the armed services in the 40s was not a big thing, and women were often put down for being a part of the services. I remember
that.
Yeah, I remember hearing stories about that when I was growing up. So why did she choose the Army?
I really can't tell you, but I'll tell you, she wanted to get into the Army quickly. Her brothers were both in the Navy, and she'd been agitating for a long time at the start of the Second World War to get in. Finally, they called her and they sent her off to boot camp. And then she's sent to Australia, and she's there for a short time, and MacArthur was there. She didn't work with him in a work situation, but he was there. And then she's transferred to New Guinea, a forward base, and the Japanese had just... they'd been cleared from the area around Finchhoven where she was sent.
Let's stop there for just a minute, because Australia was the drop-off point before she went into New Guinea, if I'm correct.
Yes.
And when she arrived, and this is a picture that you paint, which I think is very important. Imagine, those of you listening, you're a nurse, it's in the 40s, you get off of a plane, you're in woolen uniforms. When they left the U.S., it was the middle of winter. They're on the other side of the world, and it's a brown-green wool cloth. They step out of that plane, it's over 90 degrees. And you had not just the Japanese, but you had Germans that were also in the area. And I was really fascinated with how the standard was with the Americans. When the nurses came in, they had full guard units around them so that, one, they could do their work, and two, so that they wouldn't be murdered.
That's right. Whenever she went somewhere, she had to go in a jeep with a man that was armed, and if they were going off the base. And they didn't go off the base in New Guinea, but this was in Australia.
Mm-hmm. It was quite a time, and you have the time period where there were attacks on Bataan. Then in May of 42, they bombed Sydney, the Japanese did, and then on June 7th, they bombed Newcastle. On March 7th, they had landed in East New Guinea. This is really something, I think, when a younger generation looks at movies about this, they're going to have a very difficult time relating to the speed at which this war, World War II, evolved.
That's right.
And how it moved so fast.
That's right. After
the bombing at Pearl Harbor, then you had all of these other places in the world because the Japanese were determined to become a world power. And then, of course, we had the Nazis doing their world power struggle too.
That's right.
And, you know, you have two major powers going at it, and here she is, one of many women that decided, nope, this is what we're going to do. We're here for the long haul, and that is exactly what she did. And then you talk about with the POWs that were sent to the medical facilities, and how they, when they were able to rescue any of them, and they were eventually, after they were treated, they were sent to Australia. And these nurses had to deal with severe cases of typhus, dysentery, diphtheria, leprosy, bubonic plague, malaria. I mean, this was tough stuff. They didn't have anything close to what we have today in modern-day environments, modern-day hospitals.
And there's a story of the POW that who actually saw the death march through his binoculars in the Philippines. And then he was there for a couple years, and then they put him on a hell ship going to Japan. And there were 700 men, standing room only. And a lot of men died, and they were just thrown overboard. And a cup came down at night with water, they knew they were going to survive. And his cup did not come down one night. But his buddy gave him half of his cup of water so that he could survive. And, I mean, this was a terrifying trip. Then he went, when he reached Japan, they had him working in a coal mine. And he got pneumonia. A lot of the men died of pneumonia. And then after the war ends, the Japanese are running around trying to get them to eat and fatten up, and because this 220-pound Marine was down to 121 pounds, and they were afraid they were going to be punished, these Japanese. And and then her brother comes to visit her from Subic. He risks his life going through the jungle on a supply truck, and when he left, she heard all these rifles going off in the jungle and thought he'd been killed. But she asked someone, and they said, no, the war is over. And everybody was shooting everything they had in the air. And she said it made it memorable that he came to see her that very day.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jamie, in the late 40s, she ended up becoming a neuropsychiatric nurse.
Yes.
And she was in Fort Sam Houston in Texas. There was a lot going on, and she was given the rank of First Lieutenant, Army Nurse Corps, on April 28, 1948, and then became Captain on July 27, 1949. And in 1950, she was sent to the U.S. Naval Hospital at Portsmouth, Virginia. And then she was on her way to Yokohama, Japan in 52. I mean, this woman ended up traveling all over the place because she had decided she was going to have a marriage in her life, and that marriage was her career. And she just kept on going. She was in the U.S. States Army Hospital at the neuropsychiatric ward, and that was in 1953. And the facility she was in, it was for support of the Korean operations for the men and women,
yes,
who were fighting the Korean War in South Korea.
Yes.
I mean, this is something that a lot of people, male or female, would have said, I want to be as far away from any of this action as possible. The Korean War was just brutal, absolutely brutal.
Yeah. And a lot of nurses would not become neuropsychiatric nurses. They were afraid of it. But Jamie wasn't afraid of anything in her whole life. And she just figured this would be her best way to serve.
Now, she also was a nurse to a school. It was
yes.
a Camp Yokohama Dependent School System. And there
yes.
was five schools. And
yes.
that was 1,850 students. She had a wonderful rapport.
Yes,
with the Japanese culture. Wherever she went, Jamie always left things better than they had been. Mm. And it was with the people that she had such a tremendous effect, because there was a trust. This is a woman that was, and it would, I would say even today, still committed to just giving the best that she had. That was first and foremost in her mind.
She thought of other people instead of herself, always.
And she believed strongly in education, and she encouraged women. I had to chuckle when I saw the comment about when she was in Japan. The Japanese men were terrified of American women because they knew how to drive. That just made me laugh.
Yeah.
But again, you have a culture. Here in America, during the Second World War, that is when women said, I can do things on my own. They were the ones running the factories. The guys were dying out on the battlefields. The women were running things at home, and they did a beautiful job.
Yes,
and in our culture, that was a big, okay, the gals can do it. There's no reason for this attitude about women. But we had to step back a little bit here in the United States with that and then move forward again. And wherever Jamie went, she just said, I can do it. I'll take care of it.
Mm-hmm. She was a take-charge person.
She really, really was. Now,
and in my book, I build her into the powerful of woman as a lieutenant colonel, even though she did not comport herself that way, that she did have the rank and power.
Yes, she did. But that she was of the mindset, who cares? She reminds me of I can't remember his rank. He was really up there quite a bit. I did a class with him. This was a few years back, and his name was Robbie. And I had no idea that he had the rank and file that he had, but Jamie reminds me of Robbie. Robbie, although he had this high level of rank, you never saw him ever promoting that. He was just Jamie to everybody. Not Jamie, but Robbie. And what happened one day, he said there are a few times that he really used his rank for purposes. He came across some obnoxious officer that was a lesser grade than himself. It was really giving him a hard time, and that's when he pulled rank.
Oh, good for him.
Put him in a place. So Jamie was just like Robbie in many respects. She didn't pull rank on anybody. She would just say, this is what I do. This is where I am. Now, the story that really touched me, too, this woman is incredible. She ends up taking her mother with her.
Yes.
And that, I wouldn't have thought that the military would have allowed that, but she made sure that she took care of her mother, and her mother traveled with her to so many different places.
And she said that was the greatest time of, both of them said it was the greatest time of their lives. And her mother used to love to tell people, I'm the oldest Army brat. And she'd wander off when they were in different countries in Europe, and she'd find her surrounded by men trying to kiss her, and she said, I can't leave you alone for a minute. You get into trouble. She said, I can't help it if I'm cute. But her mother was very special to her. In fact, eventually she turned down the rank of bird colonel because of her mother. She had a heart condition, and they wanted to send her to Colorado, and her mother came first before her career.
One of the things that she was so good at working with were the veterans that had post-traumatic stress syndrome. And one of the things that you talk about in your book, which was really very meaningful to me, because I have had relatives in the family, they have passed away now, but they were in World War II, and the PTSD really affected them. And there's a story where she's working in an intensive care unit. There's action going on. The patients, one of them really was terrified, and she said, okay, I need to get some apples. And she runs over to the mess hall, gets the apples, hands out the apples to the patients who were all hiding underneath the beds. And she said, you've got a helmet full of apples. You hand them out to these guys because these men are used to having weapons in their hands and being able to fight back. You can't fight back. You're not in a place where you can, but get under the mattress and hold the apple. And I thought to myself when I read that, it's so difficult for people to be able to relate to what a soldier has gone through and what their survival has meant in their lives and the things that they've seen. And her thoughtfulness at getting an apple putting it in the hands of a man, even though he had nothing with which to defend himself, psychologically, he was holding on to something.
Yes.
That is how profound a woman I think she is.
Yes.
Now let's talk about, in our few minutes remaining, the Vietnam Women's Memorial. When I have walked through that area in Washington, D.C., I have a tremendous sense of emotion that hits me. Now, by the grace of God, I've not ever had to see the war front. But I have talked with innumerable veterans. I have talked with men and women that have seen hideous things in life. So I really have some kind of an empathy for this. And the Vietnam Women's Memorial really was a journey. And she was one of the grand dames behind getting this accomplished. Tell us about this memorial.
Well, in 1983, she met Diane Carlson Evans, who was the founder of the memorial. And she met her when the memorial was in its infant stages. And a lot of the senior nurses did not want to participate. I don't know if they didn't trust Diane or what it was, but when Jamie came on board as a senior nurse, things started to happen. And she was the fundraiser for the memorial and worked closely with Diane on all the matters. And she gave thousands of dollars of her own money to the memorial. And the Vietnam War was an unpopular war, and most of the nurses came home. They were spit on and yelled at as traitors. Some were bitter about the nation not being behind their efforts. Some were so traumatized by the war that they could not even speak about their experiences to anyone. And so the memorial is there for the healing of these women who were in that war. There were 265,000 women in the Vietnam War around the world serving in different capacities. And there were many meetings with the National Memorial Commission. And they wanted to make revisions after 8.5 years. And they're at this meeting, and Jamie always sat with her cane in the front row. And her cane came down with a very loud thump, and she said very loudly, "I'll be dead by then." And this made an impact because it only took 6 months, and Glenna Goodacre was designing the memorial. And the dedication was on Veterans Day, November 11, 1993. And there wasn't a dry eye when that memorial was unveiled. And Jamie said to me, "This was my greatest accomplishment in my life." There were many distinguished visitors there and speakers at the unveiling, and Rolling Thunder was there, and they loved Jamie, and they took her on their in the trike and put a helmet on her and a bandana and T-shirt, and all the vets, the Rolling Thunder, took her all around the Pentagon and the memorials, and when she got back, she said, "I had to reach the age of 80 to ride a motorcycle."
For those of you listening, if you're not familiar with the Vietnam Women's Memorial Project, as was just stated, it was founded to promote the healing for women veterans. It was not acknowledged that women that served had anything like PTSD. They were virtually ignored for the traumas that they had experienced. And this is for those that served in Vietnam and humanitarian organizations, and to remind those generations growing up in this country that it takes commitment and a sense of service and responsibility, and to understand that freedom has to be earned. It is not something that's just given to you. The 250,000 served in Japan, Guam, Hawaii, the Philippines, and Vietnam. This memorial is the first in the U.S.'s history to honor the patriotic service of women, also honoring the families who lost their loved ones who served at war. It stands about 6 feet 8 inches tall, weighs 1 ton, and it is a very special thing that we've been able to have you as a guest today. Beverly, I really appreciate what you've done. This book is phenomenal. The Colonel is a lady. Beverly Thompson, for those of you that have daughters, it might be good to share this story with them, to let them know that women of courage often are quiet, in their lives. They just go about doing. But that you can have courage. You can do things that nobody ever imagines you're capable of doing. You can go beyond the ordinary and then some. The website you can check out is thecolonelisalady.com. Beverly Thompson, you did a fabulous job in honoring this woman. I'm so pleased that we were able to chat today. Thank you for being
my
guest.
Thank you so much.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. The Colonel is a Lady. Check it out.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are open, 888-627-6008. Give me a buzz if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. I wanted to share with you a real fun story. Well, I don't know that it's a fun story. Let's call it a unique story about alligators. Ah, yes, that's right. You never know what you're going to hear about on the Donna Sebo Show. Well, how would you like a 2-foot-long alligator falling under your porch out of nowhere? And you live in Evansville, Indiana? Well, that's exactly what happened on May 21st, 1911. There was a Mrs. Winchell, and an alligator was found trying to crawl into her house. Well, in Indiana, the sight of an alligator, that means war. I mean, you're not going to let that thing survive. So she, got her friends, and they went after that gator. I guess they didn't have a humane society available at that time. And then there's another report in 1960, a Mr. and Mrs. Tucker. They heard this strange sound in their backyard. They found in their backyard a 60-pound, 5-foot-long alligator. There are no alligators. They said, where did it come from? I mean, 5 feet long in their backyard? It fell from somewhere. They said, where else but the sky? In 1892, one was found. We're backstepping a little bit in time, and a Wisconsin riverbank. It was frozen to death. In 1877, a man, a physician, actually saw the item fall from the sky and crawl towards his tent. Where was he? Savannah River in South Carolina. It was a small alligator. A few seconds later, another one fell. This doctor ended up finding 6 12-inch alligators within 200 yards of his tent. That was quite a camping excursion. They say the most oddly placed alligator appeared in 1934. Now, where did this appear? The most unlikely place. It was the U.S. Navy dirigible called the Macon. There was a leading chief. His name was Shaky Davis. He was wandering about. The airship was crossing into California when he heard a loud splashing overhead, and it happened to be in one of the ballast bags. Well, he was really concerned that the vessel was going to go down. So he climbed the rigging. The splashing got louder, and when he opened the bag, There was a 24-inch alligator swimming around. How did it get into the bag? Couldn't figure it out. Never figured it out. 1935, Harlem River, New York. Teenage boys opened a manhole cover to shovel snow into it, and they saw something moving. And you know how it is with boys, the curiosity really gets pretty intense. Well, they made a lasso and hauled a 7.5-foot, 125-pound alligator to the surface. It snapped at one of the kids, and they ended up killing it with shovels. I remember stories when I was growing up about the sewers in New York, because lots of times people would go to Florida and they'd bring the little baby alligators they were able to get, and they'd flush them down the toilet. Same thing with snakes. So when people are down in the sewers, they have to be a little thoughtful, because you never know what you're going to be encountering. But I just thought that that was an interesting story, and just never know when one of those little reptilian critters are going to be popping up into your space. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with George Galderisi. Now, George is one of the authors that worked with Tom Clancy on a book called The Act of Valor. There's been a movie made. I've not yet had the opportunity to watch the movie, but this is a powerful subject, and we're going to be talking about this tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we're going to be having a Best of Donna. I'm going to be speaking before the Chamber of Commerce in Silverdale, Washington. So because of the commute time, I'm not going to be doing the show, but we'll be playing the replay from last week, Healing from Heaven. So if you missed it, you're not going to want to miss it a second time. And then we're going to be talking about Prepare for the Landing, Michael Elgeon. And then after that, well, we're going to be putting up the list for the upcoming guests in the next month. That'll be being posted pretty soon, so you'll have information on that in due time. Which, by the way, you can go to my website, check on the visitors that we will be having or the guests we will be having on the show. And also, I want to apologize to those of you who have been trying to get through on donna@delphiinternational.com. We're having a challenge with our server. So if you're wanting to reach me by email, do donna@comcast.net, donna@comcast.net, and that way you'll be sure to get through. I don't know why, we're just having this particular challenge. It's been going on for a while, and we've had difficult time clearing it up, so I just wanted to let you know that. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. The telephone number to call in to is 888-627-6008. I'm never ceased to be amazed by surveys that are done, reports that are done. I came across one that, in a way, I thought was absolutely ridiculous. But if you study body language, appearance, you realize that there are facts of impact that the visual has on people. Well, this is a survey that was done, some research done, and it has to do with Chinese face reading. Mm-hmm. The Chinese were doing this a long, long time ago. So apparently, your smile, your lips, can reveal a lot about you and who you are. Now, if you have real thin lips, you thrive on freedom. And you really like being in charge of your own products. People like to let you lead. If you have a wide pair of lips, and, you know, a lot of women go around and they have the Botox to the lips, which makes them look like inflated tires sometimes. They're so big. Anyway, I know I've got an attitude about that. Anyway, if it's naturally, if you naturally have wide lips, it means that you're a very friendly person. You like to get together with people and you're very empathetic. If you have upward turning lips, confidence is your issue. And you have so much to offer. You're very much an optimist. If your lips are heart-shaped, this is something that shows that you are a charmer. You really like a support network. You're very good at pulling a big one together. You people are very supportive of you typically. And if you have full lips, you're a generous caretaker. Shows that you're very giving and you tend to sacrifice your needs too often. and feel guilty if you ever have to say no. Well, that's a little bit of trivia that we have. We're closing out the show today. I'm so delightful you were able to join me on this wonderful holiday. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. And on this day, give thought to those men and women who, for many generations, have given their lives of service because they believed in something bigger than themselves. You can do the same thing in your own way. We don't have to go to war. We can just live life with quality and being true to ourselves. This is Donna Sebo. Talk with you tomorrow. Same time, same place, right here on BBS Radio. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.